For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and coming up today, Read On reporter Ellie Marsh returns to the Sunderland shipyards during wartime with author Nancy Revell. We drop in on a picnic in the park and find some off-duty narrators. And I catch up with S.D. Robertson to discuss his latest novel, The Daughter's Choice. That's all coming up on today's Read On.
Writing as Nancy Revell, Amanda Walton is the author of the Sunday Times best-selling series, The Shipyard Girls, in which we follow the lives of a team of woman welders in the harsh world of the Sunderland shipyards during the Second World War. She joined me from her home ahead of the release of the 11th and penultimate book in the series, Shipyard Girls Under the Mistletoe. Hello, Amanda, and welcome to Read On.
Hi, Ellie. It's lovely to be here. Thank you for asking me.
So for anybody who hasn't yet crossed paths with Rosie and Polly and Gloria and the rest of the Shipyard Girls crew, can you set the scene for us, what the Shipyard Girls is, what it's about, where it's set, and a little bit of background?
Okay, so it's a series for starters. So I'm just coming to the final book, believe it or not. So there's 12 books in the series. They start just at the start of World War II. So I think the first one is roughly around the sort of August, September time, 1940, which is really when World War II kind of got going. I mean, you know, people who know the history will probably know that it was called the Phony War previous to that, so there wasn't huge amounts happening. So I set the series then, when things were beginning. I've set the series in Sunderland at Tyne and Wear, which at the time was County Durham, and I set it there because that is my hometown and where I was born and brought up. And the setting is in the shipyards, believe it or not, which was where a group, well, was 700 women at the time in real life actually worked there in World War II. So I use that as the premise for the series. So the series looks at this group of women who have different ages, different backgrounds, that come to do their bit for the war in the Sunderland shipyards during World War II. And then we meet them early on, and the series takes us all the way through to the end of the war and kind of charts their lives, their loves, their secrets. Yeah, against the backdrop of what was happening in the war in Sunderland and also in the wider arena of the UK and worldwide.
And it's something that people might not even know. You know, you think of the shipyards and it's such a male-dominated world that people might, you know, women in the shipyards, what's that about?
Yeah, I know. And you know what? There's still so little known. I do tend to get on my hobby horse a little bit about, you know, informing people, just simply because they seem to have been overlooked in our history books. When I first came to sort of researching the subject, sort of, you know, way before I started writing the series, I was looking at sort of lots of other work women did in World War II. And, you know, there's been a lot written about the women who worked in the munitions factories, the women who worked as the land girls, but absolutely nothing about women who worked in the shipyards. So obviously there was women working in the shipyards, not just in Sunderland, but in other places as well. I mean, I just concentrated on Sunderland. But, you know, there's just been very, very little. And I really struggled to find anything written about them, to be honest with you. So, you know, I've kind of hope to achieve two things by this series. One is just basically to give people a really good series which they can get into and they enjoy and they can escape into. But at the same time, kind of throw light on these women that did this really hard job during the war and didn't really get any thanks for it or any kind of recognition, to be honest.
That's exactly it. And as soon as the men came back, it was sort of, you know, women go back to the kitchens and go back to the homes. Do you think that that'll happen? Do you think that'll happen at the end of the series?
Well, you know, this is it. I mean, I do have to keep kind of within the confines of what would really have happened at the time. And yeah, I mean, basically, there will be a couple of characters that sort of, I don't want to give it too much away, but a couple of them will stay on. But the majority do leave as what would have happened at that time in real life. And it has to be said that Funny enough, I was talking about this to somebody the other day, and I was sort of saying, oh, you know, it's outrageous, you know, they were sort of kind of booted out of their jobs, you know, when the men came back from war. And then I can't remember who I was speaking to, and they said, well, I can kind of understand that because it was their job originally, and it was just kind of a temporary fill-in. And to be fair, I think probably a lot of those women were probably happy to leave that job because, you know, they weren't just working the shipyard. They were also looking after families, doing the shopping, doing the cooking. So they were probably quite relieved in a way that they could just concentrate on one job rather than two. And they were pretty exhausted. But, you know, the women that I have heard sort of interviewed myself who worked in the shipyards, I mean, they all talked about it with great fondness and with smiles on their faces and in their voices. But I think they were all kind of accepting of the fact that they would have to sort of leave once the war ended.
Sunderland has got a special place in my heart. So I went to university there. And it's so nice when you're reading the books to know the area that the books are writing about. And Sunderland's not somewhere that, you know, you get books about, there's lots of books about the history of Glasgow and cities like London and Manchester and Birmingham. But Sunderland, you don't really read it and think, oh, I know where that street is. Whereas in these ones, you do.
Yeah. And do you know, this was partly why I decided to set the series in Sunderland, because while I was a journalist and, you know, there were ideas going through my head for fiction, the one sort of constant in that was the place. I was always determined to set whatever story I wrote in Sunderland for that reason, because I just felt like, you know, it was different for starters. So it wasn't going to be, you know, say Oxford or London, like we say, or Edinburgh. And it would just give people, I don't know, a different sort of perspective on things. And so I hope people, and I do get lovely feedback from people who aren't from the area, who actually say, I feel like I know Sunderland now, you know. And there's actually some walks that happen every month or so that happen in the town. And some people actually have come from different towns just to come to do those walks and re-walk those streets where certain actions happen.
That's so lovely.
It's a real compliment to feel that people are that enmeshed in the story and the characters that they want to kind of relive it by actually walking down the streets and
seeing the scenery of that the women would have seen and things like that, the river and everything. Yeah. So through the books, obviously the bond between these women, it's like they're a family, you know, when their families are away at war, their husbands and their children are away at war, they've got each other. Was that something that you set out to write about, sort of friendship between women, or was it something that just came naturally because of the story and where the story's set?
I think that was something that I've always been drawn to. I mean, I've always been hugely interested in women's issues and, you know, women's place in society. And I think I was naturally just sort of drawn to write about a group of women. I think even if it hadn't been set in World War II, I would have probably still had that same sort of template of a small group of women and the dynamics of their sort of friendships and lives and how they sort of interlinked. So that was something that I've always been interested in, quite kind of close to my heart.
And the subplots in the book range, you know, from different issues for women, but also different issues in society. You cover things like domestic abuse, divorce, infidelity, love, friendship, loads and loads of different themes. How did you find writing about things like infidelity or domestic abuse that sometimes could be a little bit tricky to write about?
Yes, I mean, I think this is where my journalism kind of has stood me in good stead, because I did an awful lot of stories and features and investigations on abuse, mainly towards women, whether that be domestic or otherwise. And I had interviewed too many women that had been abused and involved in domestic violence. So I felt like I had a real insight, you know, of that. And I had got inside their heads whilst writing features on them. So I felt like I was writing about and knew what I was writing about. I don't think there's anything in the series that I've kind of written about that I don't kind of know, either through my own personal experience or through my time as a journalist.
She had been as quiet as a mouse, so as not to wake him, as she didn't trust herself, didn't feel she could force out any kind of civil morning greeting to him or pull her mouth into a smile. She felt her face was like an open book, and on it was written all the hatred she felt towards Vinny for what he had put her through. She was more than aware that work today was going to be awkward, and she felt a little nervous about seeing the women this morning after they'd clocked her bruises yesterday. But now they had seen the worst. She had nothing more to hide. In an odd way, she felt liberated. There was no more covering up, no more pretense.
Something else that I really enjoyed about the books is consistent throughout the books, being able to relate to these women, which is kind of bizarre because it's set in World War II, you know, nearly 100 years ago. But the themes are sort of universal. It's like love and friendship and loss and all things like that. And it's weird because it's a completely different world, but you still relate to these women completely.
Yes, and that's really interesting that you say that, because at the moment we're sort of looking at just getting sort of producers and TV interested in taking the Shipyard Girls and putting them, you know, on TV. And that's kind of the discussions that we've been having have been that exactly, is that although it's set so long ago, the issues are still really contemporary. And I think I really wanted to do that within the book, so it wasn't just kind of nostalgic. It was kind of something that women nowadays could really relate to. So, you know, I have other things in there as well, like not being able to have children and, you know, all those things, you know, which is still very, very predominant these days. And emotional abuse as well as the physical abuse. And like you say, sort of bereavement and things like that. So I'm very proud of the fact that I feel like I've managed to do that, to bring a contemporary feel to a historical book.
It is. It does feel contemporary and you can really relate to the different characters. Is it, I'm thinking like a Sunday night drama. It would fit so well.
Definitely, definitely, yes, yes. There are producers interested in it. It's just unfortunately producers that need to find people that will put the money into it. But yeah, definitely Sunday viewing, isn't it? Yes.
Absolutely. It's a long process, I know, but you'll have to keep us updated with that. That's so exciting.
Don't worry, definitely.
So the book, the audiobooks, are read wonderfully by Janine Burkett. How much input did you have on the audiobooks and how involved were you in that process?
Not hugely, to be honest. I mean, I'm just looking at the recent one now with Janine, and she's just so brilliant, isn't she? She actually comes from the area, so she's got the accents down to a T. And the fact that she sort of, what amazes me about her is that she does, you know, there's obviously a lot of characters in the books and there's a lot of sort of main characters as such. So she manages to get their personalities across just through her voice and changing her accents, and just incredible. So obviously she's a very good actress as well, from what I can gather. So no, I didn't really have much to do, basically, because Janine does it all. Yeah, yes.
You're saying about her accent, she does get it down to a T. Like, it's not a Geordie accent, it's a Macam accent. And she does it really, really well.
Yeah, she does, doesn't she? It's just brilliant. Yeah, so I just, hands off to her. She's done the whole series now, and it's been fab.
Do you think that, obviously, we've all been in a pandemic for the last, feels like forever, 18 months or however long it's been now. How do you think that that's affected the way that you write, having lived through a pandemic and the lockdowns, which has been the biggest sort of change to our lives since possibly the Second World War, and having lived through that, do you think it's affected the way that you write at all?
I don't think it's affected the way I write. I mean, for starters, it kind of gave me more time in a way to sort of concentrate even more on the books than I already was, because obviously, you know, we were all locked down. But one thing that did come through with that, and I actually wrote a piece on it, which was relating the war years to what we were experiencing during the intense lockdown in particular, you know, because there was quite a few sort of correlations which sort of occurred to me, the whole sort of, you know, that sense of people all being in this boat together, sort of fighting something that was causing havoc, basically. And so on that score, it gave me more of a feel of what it would be like during World War II, that sense of everybody coming together and trying to support each other. You know, it seems a long time ago now, but, you know, when we were all out there clapping and, you know, really sort of supporting one another, that came through. And I felt like that probably transferred into the writing and kind of even more of my understanding of that time.
You're completely right. Like, all fighting the same thing together and also not being able to see the people that you love in some cases, you know, being isolated from being away from people that you wish you could be with in this time.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, definitely. Definitely. And, you know, people dying and that sense of sort of bereavement and also the sense of not knowing what was around the corner. Because sometimes I think as a writer, you can forget that because obviously we know what happened at the end of World War II. But you, when you sort of put yourself in those shoes, obviously they didn't. They didn't know they were going to win. So I kept having to remind myself while I was writing the books that of that sense of uncertainty. And I really felt that during, you know, the lockdown and the pandemic, before the vaccine came along, of that uncertainty. What is going to happen, you know?
So is it the 11th or 12th? Book in the series that's been released. It's the 11th, isn't it, that's been released next month?
Yes, so the 11th is, it's published at the end of October, I think it's on the 28th of October, and that is sort of, it's got a Christmassy title, but it's not necessarily just about Christmas. So that's Shipyard Girls Under the Mistletoe, and that takes you from the sort of middle of 1944 to the end, kind of ends around the Christmas time. And then the last book, which is book 12, which I've just finished, which is Three Cheers for the Shipyard Girls. That is the final one, and that's published in March next year.
I just wanted to touch briefly on the fact that Sunderland will be, I'm not really sure where we are with the statue at the minute, but they're going to be paying sort of respect and commemorating the real life shipyard girls, which has been sort of brought to the forefront of everybody's minds because of the Shipyard Girls books. How does that feel to know now that the real women are going to be commemorated in the city?
Huge. And it just feels also, I mean, it just, so you know, it will happen. It's just because of COVID and everything, it's really slowed the whole process down. But, you know, we've got this amazing sort of artist who's doing it and actually producing the public artwork. And it's going to go, hopefully, near where the Thompson's Shipyard used to be on the Weir. But it just feels, I think if it wasn't happening, I think I would continue to campaign for something to be put in Sunderland to commemorate them. You know, I feel that strongly about it. So I just feel really heartened and glad that they are being recognised. And I think that'll probably continue even after the series ends. I think it'll be always something that I'm happy to speak about and push out there and make people aware of.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Amanda. And I'm really looking forward to the next book coming out in October and the final book in the series coming out later on. Yeah, how exciting.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. And, you know, I hope anybody out there who starts reading the books or listens to the books, they do them in big print as well, enjoys it. Most of all, I hope they just enjoy it and escape.
You can find all 10 of the Shipyard Girls series of books at the RNIB Library. Amanda will be joining us at the end of the show to share with us the books of her life.
We know just how important reading can be for everyone, whether that's to keep you busy or just to put a smile on your face. The RNIB Reading Services online library is here for you. Register for an account at readingservices.rnib.org.uk and start reading straight away. Browse and download from our growing collection of over 30,000 talking books, newsagent titles, and even sheet music on your smartphone, tablet, computer, or other reading devices. RNIB Reading Services allows you to keep your books until you're finished, and there's no need to renew. Get talking books in DAISY format. Enjoy a selection of e-braille books to work on an electronic braille display, such as the Orbit Reader 20. Search for RNIB Reading Services online or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and tell them you're interested in the Reading Services Library or any other of the great RNIB services we offer.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, S.D. Robertson reveals how lockdown seeped into his latest novel. But before that, let's journey back a couple of years and catch up with some off-duty narrators. On a sunny Sunday in September, I ventured down to Regent's Park in London for the inaugural audiobook workers' picnic. Though the park was crowded, one group of revellers appeared to be in finer voice than the rest. Guided by their voices, I found some old friends, First among them, David Thorpe, who helped organise the event.
Right, I am a member of the Audiobook Working Party, the Equity, the Entertainment Workers Trade Union. I have an audiobook working party who look at all issues relating to audiobooks. And probably a couple of years ago now, we had a meeting which various narrators came to. And someone said, wouldn't it be nice to do something informal, get everyone together, have a bit of something like a picnic? And so this year, we finally got ourselves together and organised a picnic, and this is it. It's been very well attended, I'm delighted to say, not only by narrators, it's been open to everyone. There have been producers are here, we've got people from the admin staff working on audiobooks, we've got an agent, all sorts of people have come along. Basically, I've just stuck an Equity flag in a tree, and they've come. Yeah, so that's how it came about.
How many years have you been a narrator?
When I began narrating audiobooks, it was onto steam cassette. I've been doing them now since the early or mid-1990s, I think. 95, something like that, 1995. Yes, and they genuinely were onto reel-to-reel tape. Because I started at the RNIB, and still read at the RNIB, but that's, that they were on tape, and it's all digital now.
I actually recognise quite a lot of the voices round here. It does seem that RNIB has been the centre of excellence that has populated the now very popular audiobook world.
So true. Looking around, there are a lot of narrators here, many, many of who started out at the RNIB. Yeah, definitely.
For anybody who wants to pick up a great audiobook, what have you worked on lately that's really stuck out for you?
I've thought of a lovely book and I've forgotten the name of the writer, so you'll have to look that up, but it's called Something to Live For. That's one that I've done that I've really, really enjoyed. I did a very interesting book for RNIB about a cyclist who I'd never heard of, I'm ashamed to say, called Fausto Coppi, which I've just finished. Italian cyclist, amazing, I mean, brilliant, genius sportsman, but also an amazing sort of life because, well, I don't want to spoil it for you, but he had an affair with a woman at a time when adultery was illegal in Italy. And that was, that's an amazing book. It's called Fallen Angel.
So here's another voice that I recognise from the RNIB studios. Lucy, do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, yes, hello, I'm Lucy Scott. I often read for the RNIB. In fact, I'm about to go in 2 weeks' time to read a lovely novel by Lucy Mallinson called Threepenny. Oh, God, I'll have to look it up. But it's a sort of an autobiography. She was a thriller writer in the First World War. So it's quite unusual for a woman to be writing thrillers then. So she wrote under a pseudonym, Anthony Gilbert, I think her name was. His name. His name.
Gender is very fluid in the 21st century, well, yes. And clearly was in the 20th.
Yes, obviously.
Can you remember the first book that you did for the RNIB?
I can't remember the title, but I do remember it was in Great Portland Street before it moved to Camden. And I remember clearly I had an engineer called Peter, who's subsequently left, and he was so helpful. Because I just turned up with all these sort of accents and energy, and I thought, this is what you want. And actually he said, no, whoa, whoa, whoa. Calm down and allow the story to take over. You know, just give a little flavour to all the characters and disappear into the background and allow... And that was such good advice. And so I always think of him when I'm sort of preparing a book, especially a kid's book, actually. You do need a bit more energy, but not so much. So, it was a sort of children's book, the first one. Really enjoyed it. And there were two studios for one engineer. So it wasn't great time keeping, if you see what I mean. So if the other reader mucked up, and the engineer was dealing with them, you would just have to wait. So, and you're only really paid for the time that you actually record. So, it wasn't ideal. So Camden is brilliant. It's really good.
And could you ever have imagined that audiobooks would have become as successful as they are now?
Well, I'm so pleased that it is a successful, because I've always loved audio. I'll always listen to audio myself. I mean, it's theatre for one, isn't it? It's absolutely, and it takes you off into another world. So I've loved it. I couldn't really understand why anyone else wouldn't, but God bless technology for being able to make it so easy to download and to, you know, sit on a train or go for a walk and listen. I mean, it's wonderful, and I'm so delighted. I mean, personally as well, just because there's just more work around. So I love it. Love audiobooks.
And final question, I heard you and David talking a little bit earlier about a favourite audiobook that you've got at the moment.
David showed me a book that he'd recorded and I listened to it and I was bowled over. It was called Stumm. And it was, I thought it was actually true, but he said it was based on somebody's life. So it is a piece of fiction, but it's set during the Second World War and it's about a Jewish family. And I was blubbing at the end, and David did just an amazing, amazing job. Really wonderful. All the characters, well, you know, he gave them all a flavour, but my goodness, they leapt out. It was wonderful.
My name is Catherine Fenton. I've been narrating audiobooks for 16 years. I'm an American. I love narrating audiobooks because for me, it's a little bit like taking one art form and transposing it into another art form. And I love the responsibility that comes with that and the challenges that come with that. Love being able to tell stories. I feel very lucky to do this as my job.
And is there a book that's really stood out for you that you've narrated that just clicked with you?
Do you know, I there are several, and there are books that are very important to me because they are important books, and those are always a privilege to read. So if you read a classic, for example, or you read something that's very... I read The Shock Doctrine at the RNIB, and I love doing that one because it's such an important book. And then there are others that really appeal personally because they're just so exquisite. So at the moment I'm doing a Renee Denfield book called The Butterfly Girl, and I read her previous book, The Child Finder, and I find her work so, so tender and clever and painful and brave. And so whenever I get one of her titles, then I'm always very happy.
And is there a book that you would push all the other narrators out of the way to get your hands on and narrate?
Gosh, I don't know at the moment. No, I would say no, because for me, every time I get a script come through, it's like opening a box with a gift inside. And that's the pleasure for me, is not knowing what this is going to require or offer me or delight me with. It's like a lovely surprise every time.
Thank you for bringing to life books for those of us who are print disabled, and I wish you many, many more years of doing the same.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, hello. My name is Gordon Griffin, and I've recorded, I should check out, I think it's something like 880, that's it, 880 audiobooks. No. Yes, 880 audiobooks, yeah. Yes. I started with audiobooks a long time, in the very, very early days where there were only two audiobook companies recording, not counting RNIB. Now, I came to RNIB fairly late, about, I would say, 20 years ago. Then I started to... I applied to them, and I asked to audition, and thank goodness I passed the audition. And since then, I record on a fairly regular basis. Whenever I can, I will record for them, yes.
And is there a book that really stands out as one that you're particularly proud of recording?
Oh, that's so hard. There are so many. There was one book called Oxygen by Andrew Miller, which won me lots and lots of awards, and I had a great soft spot for that. I also love doing the audiobook of Billy Elliot because it's my story. I come from the Northeast. My granddad was a miner. And so when I was growing up in the 1950s in the Northeast, people were, and I'd say, I want to be an actor. They'd say, don't be ridiculous. You can't be an actor with a Geordie accent. And so I very much identified with Billy Elliot. And I don't know. It's wonderful recording the great writers like Dickens and Thackeray. And I did George Orwell's 1984. I mean, these are great, great books. I did Homer's Odyssey. Fantastic books for an actor to do. But what I like particularly about what I do is that I don't know what I'm going to be doing next. So somebody will say, we'd like you to record this book. And I say, yeah, great. I don't even know what the book is going to be. And that's what's exciting. The challenge is having no idea what I'm going to be recording until I get the book.
And if I could offer you any book under the sun to narrate, is there one that you would leap upon?
One of the downsides of being someone who records lots and lots of books, I know what the next five books I'm going to be recording are, for example. So I get very little chance to actually record books for my own pleasure. Not that I don't get pleasure from recording books, of course. One book that I did enjoy tremendously was Captain Corelli's Mandolin. I kept hoping that someone was going to ask me to record that. It's a huge, spectacular book, very funny, incredibly moving, and I would love to have done that, but somebody somebody else got the gig, unfortunately. But I would have liked to. I'd like to have done that.
Just before I left, I bumped into one of my favourite narrators of all times, Laurence Bouvard. Laurence, how have you been?
I've been terrific, thank you. It's lovely to see you.
And what have you been working on recently?
Oh, I've been working on a slew of books. I've got four on at the moment, but I have just finished working on a fantastic series by a woman called Haley Edwards. And it's the Bayou Born series about the four women of the apocalypse. And it's fantastic. It's got sexy dragons, it's got adorable, cuddly demons, and really evil archangels. So, like, what's not to like? Oh, and it's set in the South, so I get to use my Southern accent, too.
And have you got your next R&IB recording lined up as well?
I do. I am there in 3 weeks to do a book called In the Cut, which I'm very excited about. It's a mystery, I believe, but I haven't quite got to that manuscript yet because I have three more before that, so ask me in 2 weeks.
Could you ever have believed how popular audiobooks would become?
I'm surprised, but I'm delighted because I do think it's important because it gets the printed word out to a bunch of different people, some of whom may not have the reading skills or the attention span or the time. And I read an article recently which said that listening and reading are processed in the same way by our brain. So listening to audiobooks is brain healthy.
And actually, I think it means that people are reading, listening to far more books than they were before.
Absolutely. I think it's opened up a whole range of books to people because you can listen when you're in your car, you can listen when you're running, you can listen when you're putting your kids to sleep. And it helps time-starved people and people who just would rather listen than crack open a very big book.
So, if I could offer you any book in the world to record, what would it be?
I think it would have to be the Wizard of Oz series because I grew up with them. And there's more than just one. There's about 15. And they are the most magical, fabulous, fabulous books. And lots of opportunities for amazing voices.
Give us a witch's cackle.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
Laurence Bouvard, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of the party.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to all the narrators, producers and support staff who work so hard to bring audiobooks to life, both at R&IB and commercially.
R&IB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The R&IB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The R&IB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the R&IB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the R&IB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
This is Read On, the audiobook show from R&IB Connect Radio.
Hello, my name is Olivia and I am 20 years old. So at the moment I am using Audible by Amazon. I have it on my iPhone. And one of my favourite audiobooks at the moment is the Twilight series. I think the narration is really, really good. I think the narrator tells a story. I think she has a really good knack of making the characters come to life. I first sort of found out about these books a couple of years ago when I was bought them for my 13th birthday by my parents. I watched the films, first of all. I thought they were really good, and then I listened to the audiobooks. So I really like audiobooks in general just because I just like to sit and relax and read a book rather than having to read it myself. I like to actually listen to a book because I feel like it helps me to become more absorbed in the storyline, and it's quite relaxing as well, to be honest. Like if you're feeling stressed out, then an audiobook for me really helps, and that's why I like audiobooks.
This is Read On, the audiobook show from R&IB. Now, before we return to hear the books of Nancy Revell's life...
Since his debut in 2016, S.D. Robertson has established a reputation for writing thought-provoking, emotionally intelligent novels that leave the reader contemplating life's more positive aspects. And his latest book, The Daughter's Choice, continues in the same vein. He joined me from his home just outside Manchester.
Stuart, welcome back to Read On.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, the daughter in question is called Rose, and we join her just about a week before her wedding.
Yeah, she's a young bride-to-be. She's 22 years old. And when we first meet her, she's befriended by a mysterious older stranger, Cassie, at the Spa Hotel, literally days before her wedding. And yeah, after hitting it off, this pair, both who are staying alone at the hotel, agree to pass their time there together, sharing each other's life stories. But it soon becomes clear that Cassie knows more about Rose than she's letting on. And as the truth sort of gradually unfolds, revealing various secrets and lies, so Rose's life unravels, leaving her with an impossible choice.
And the reader senses that Cassie might have orchestrated this meeting from pretty much the beginning of the novel.
Yes.
We get to see that she's lurking in the corner.
Yeah, she's lurking in the corner, exactly. Yeah. You certainly get the sense that she's up to something, but it's not really clear what until quite a lot later in the book. So, yeah, it's very deliberately placed as, you know, this isn't necessarily who it seems to be, but read on and you'll find out more.
More so than I think any of your books before, I did find myself questioning pretty much everybody's motives in this book. You know that there's a mystery, or perhaps two, that needs to be unravelled. But it does make you question every character, because it's actually a very claustrophobic setting. Did you write this book during lockdown?
Yes, I did, actually, yes.
Because all the action pretty much takes place within the four walls of this health spa.
It does, yeah. I mean, obviously, when they're recounting their stories, we do travel quite a lot further afield because obviously they're going through their life stories. So particularly in Cassie's story, you get to visit a few different international locations. But essentially, the framing plot is all set in, yeah, the four walls, or the sort of the four boundary outside walls of this hotel and this spa complex, yeah. I actually visited a spa complex not too long before lockdown, which is probably one of the reasons it was in my head. And, you know, it's the sort of thing that no one's been able to do for a long time in lockdown as well. So I thought that was interesting.
And Cassie is a rather glamorous figure, as you say. She's travelled quite a lot. She certainly looks good for her age. And she feels very much like the kind of woman who might haunt the rooms of a health spa.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
And next to her, Rose actually starts to look quite naive.
Yeah, well, I mean, she is naive to a certain degree because, I mean, she's only 22 and it's, you know, a young age. Well, it's obviously a young age, but it's very much a young adult, aren't you, still at that age? And it's just, you get to be an adult, but at the same time, you've not lived a life, which Cassie certainly has in many ways. And I think there's an inevitable naivety to Rose, which comes out as the whole thing sort of develops.
Now, Rose has a very close relationship with her father, not least because she lost her mother quite young.
Yes. Yeah, it's very much a... I've had one of my first book, Time to Say Goodbye, that was also about a single father and a daughter. In that book, the daughter was very young, 6, I believe, from the top of my head. And obviously, in this case, the daughter's grown up, although you do sort of flashback to when she was younger, etc., with the father. But yeah, this sort of father-daughter dynamic is something I've sort of looked at, as I say, previously, and it's certainly something I have an interest in. And I think just by having a sort of single father and a single daughter, it really focuses that relationship even more so, you know.
And without giving any spoilers away, as a reaction to her conversation with Cassie, Rose has to question her relationship with her father and how his bringing her up by himself has possibly given her a lack of perspective.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true. She's sort of brought up by him very much, and she's sort of seen things through that perspective, and meeting Cassie certainly makes her look at things differently. And I think one of the things that I was very interested in writing this novel is that, you know, people can have on the one hand, you know, like, let's say he seems like very much the perfect father, that he's done this wonderful job of bringing it up. But, you know, there's different facets to everyone. Every character has the flaws as well as the good aspects. And I think, you know, that's something I very much look at in this book. And yeah, it definitely applies to a father, Dave. Perhaps also to everyone in the novel, perhaps less so Rose, but like most of the characters in the novel have sort of good and bad qualities, you know, which I think is what most people in life are like as well. You don't tend to get the sort of all good and the all bad. It's usually a bit of a mix.
I was very struck by the reviews that I read online. Pretty much every review mentions how wonderful they think the character of Dave is. What a kind man and what a role model for fathers he is.
Yeah, I think there are aspects that aren't perfect, but I think often if you have a character who is in many ways perfect and not entirely perfect, I think that makes them perhaps a more rounded character. And he certainly has done his best throughout his life to bring up his daughter in difficult situations better than maybe a lot of fathers would do, you know. And I think the fact that they are just the two of them is what's really sort of put the focus there and what's really sort of brought that out.
As you mentioned, you have dealt with father-daughter relationships in the past, and
yes.
I know that you are the father of a daughter.
Or I am.
your wife, I hasten to add, is still around.
She is, yeah.
But does your daughter read your books, and what does she think about the exploration of the father-daughter relationship?
Do you know, she hasn't read any of my books yet, although she's certainly of an age where she could. But I don't want to be the kind of dad who sort of pushes my work upon her. I've always sort of said to her, if you want to read any of them, there they are. She's got some copies of her own. But yeah, she's a teenager at the moment, and I don't think dad's job's that cool, really, at the moment. Maybe when she's a bit older, then she'll be a bit more interested. But yeah, I know she knows what the themes of my books are, certainly, and yeah, I think she's fine with it. I mean, people always say to you, particularly in your early novels, if you write about a father and daughter, everyone assumes, you know, you're writing about yourself and your daughter. And, you know, that really isn't the case with my writing. It's more a case of it's a dynamic that I understand because I've had a daughter. I always say to her, you know, just because I'm writing about a father and a daughter, it's not you and I. It's just using the dynamic. I mean, I think that's the key thing, really, when you're writing fiction. You have to sort of use, they always say, write what you know. And I think that's a bit of a misnomer. I think it's more write situations that you know and write something fictional based in those situations or those dynamics.
You described your last novel, How to Save a Life, that we discussed this time last year, as a redemption novel. How would you describe The Daughter's Choice?
I think you could say there's a redemption side to The Daughter's Choice as well. It has various different elements. There's a sort of thrillery element to it, even though it's definitely not what you'd call a thriller. There's a psychological element to it. It's obviously sort of very much about family and relationships. So yeah, I don't think it would necessarily be pigeonholed into any particular one little genre, but there's a lot of things weaved into there.
I always come away from your novels thinking that you are a great believer in second chances.
Yes, I do think so. I think that is something that weaves itself into my fiction, probably not really deliberately. I think often the themes that you explore in your novels, you don't always realize what they are until after you sit down and analyze them. But yeah, the second chances very much does feature. The unexpected nature of life seems to be something that I'm very interested in as well. But yeah, I think everyone kind of deserves a second chance, you know, maybe not a third chance if they mess it up the second time. But yeah, everyone deserves a second chance. Why not?
Do you think that's something that grew out of your many years working as a journalist on a local newspaper?
I don't know. I mean, it's not something I've thought about, if I'm honest, but I know what you're saying. I think in local papers, which is where I worked, there is always a desire to give both sides an airing of their views. It doesn't always happen in every publication these days, but I think it is important to try and give people an airing. You know, I think the great thing about journalism for me was just meeting so many different people from different backgrounds. You know, one of the things I like most about being a reporter in my sort of early days before I was sort of sat behind the desk, it was just going out and one day be talking to, say, like a homeless person on the street, the next day be talking to the CEO of a company. And I think it makes you quite a chameleon, really, because you have to sort of very much get onto the level of whoever it is and try and sort of be someone they want to talk to. And that for me was just meeting so many different characters just gives you so many different ideas and seeing that people aren't just black and white. People are grey, for want of a better word. It's a great grounding for any writer, I think, being a journalist, particularly, I think, I mean, most journalists, not everyone, but a lot of journalists start off on local papers. I mainly stayed in local papers, and I think they're just a great place for finding out about interesting people and interesting situations.
As with your previous five books, The Daughter's Choice has been brought wonderfully to life as an audiobook, this time by three female narrators, including somebody we know well from the RNIB Talking Books studios, Kate Akello.
It's the first time I've ever had three narrators. I've had two narrators before for my second novel, I think it was. There was a male and a female on that one. But yeah, this one, it was put to me that they thought it would be a good idea to have three different voices. And I thought that was really nice. I think it sort of helps. I've not actually heard it yet, I have to say. I'm waiting to do so and excited to do so. But yeah, I think it's really nice to have these three different voices conveying the different voices of the novel.
I'm assuming that Avon HarperCollins sent you examples of each of the narrator's voices for you to choose from a list.
They did, yes. Yeah.
Is that a part of the job that you enjoy?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, and I think it is really important. All the people they've sent on a list, you know, they're all great. They're all professionals. They're all doing it. But yeah, sometimes you just hear someone, you think, yeah, I think that person will work really well with that voice because, you know, they're going to be reading that voice for a lot of pages to, you know, people going to be hearing that voice. So yeah, you want it to sound like the voice in your head, I suppose, the one you've come up with when you've written it.
So, Stuart, you are famous for writing great dialogue. And I wonder if the narrator's voices ever sound very different to the voices of the characters as you imagine them?
I think, yeah, inevitably they sound different because, you know, part of the job of a narrator is to put their own spin on it and their own nuances to the thing. And I think sometimes, you know, they maybe bring things out of dialogue that you didn't even know were there. And I think that's wonderful when that happens. But I always really, really like writing dialogue. It's probably my favourite part. I could sit and write dialogue all day long. I don't know where that comes from. I think it possibly comes from, again, newspapers sort of writing what people say and when you've attended meetings and that kind of thing. I always like that too. But yeah, dialogue, I think reading it or listening to it, it's a sort of quite snappy, fast part. And I think that's often what the readers like, to get the pages flowing. So yeah, I do enjoy dialogue.
And do you enjoy narrators reading dialogue to you, or are you still hooked to your Kindle?
I'm happy to do both, actually. I'm very much a Kindle reader as opposed to a paperback reader these days, mainly because I like reading in bed and I don't want to keep my wife awake with the light being on. Yeah, I do read a lot on my Kindle, but yeah, I do also really enjoy listening as well, because I'm doing this now on Bluetooth earphones. And for me, they've really sort of revolutionized listening to anything, really, whether it's a podcast or whether it's an audiobook, because you can just stick them in your ears and go about doing things while you're listening to it. So if you've got to paint the fences or something like that, you can listen to a book while you're doing it. Or if you want to go for a walk, you can listen to it. And, you know, that flexibility. And I think if it's a really good narrator as well, it's a whole different experience. I think that's fantastic. And I think, obviously, they've really grown in recent years. And hopefully they'll continue to do so, because I know more and more people now who are interested in listening to books, and often people who had lost the love of reading and sort of refined it by listening.
I certainly class myself as somebody who had rediscovered my love of reading, because I can now listen to such a wide range of books. And certainly we have to be very grateful to your publisher, HarperCollins, who make all their books available to members of the RNIB library on the day of publication. So yours is already in the library.
Lovely. That's great.
And I take it that you are already hard at work on the seventh novel.
I am, yes. I've been working on it today. Do you know what? I'm not really very good at talking about books at an early stage. Mm-hmm. I like to keep it very much to myself until I feel that it's got its final start and end and that kind of thing. And I'm very much embroiled in the middle of it at the moment. So I can't really say I can give too much away.
Well, doubtless we'll find out all about it this time next year. And one super important question that I have been told to ask by one of your fans who heard last year's interview is, how is Bernard the cat?
He's very well, thank you. He is. He's not been too bothered by lockdown. And I think right now he's asleep on the couch. But yeah, he's always here to keep an eye on me.
And still your constant companion all the way through writing.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, fantastic. I will look forward to another update on him and you. For the meantime, SD Robertson, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On and introducing us to The Daughter's Choice.
Thank you.
A gift in your will is a really special way to continue supporting RNIB. Large or small, all gifts can have a huge impact on our services, as our work is vital and our services are needed more than ever. Over a third of the work we do is funded by the generosity of supporters who leave a gift in their will to RNIB. If you leave a legacy, you will make a significant difference to the lives of blind and partially sighted people, so their future is full of opportunity. Creating a will offers you the chance to make sure the people and causes you care about most are supported for years to come. We've made it easier for you to write or update your will with our free, accessible and simple will writing services. To find out more, please call 0303 123 9999 or go to rnib.org.uk/legacy.
Now it's back to Nancy Revell for the books of her life.
Hello, Amanda. Welcome to Books of Your Life. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Ellie. Thanks for having me.
So on Books of Your Life, we like to talk about the book that inspired you when you were a child to start reading and writing, the book that you like to curl up with on a rainy day and reread, and the book that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend. So let's kick off right at the beginning. Can you remember the book that you first read that got you into reading and made you want to read more and possibly to write as well?
In my hand now, I have the book that I actually read at the time, and it's a lovely hardback, it's huge, Doorstepper, Roots, Alex Haley. And that's, I'm kind of amazed that I read it because I was quite young. I mean, just trying to think, I was only about 10. I think I found it in the house and I just started reading it, and it just something, I don't know what it was, it just sort of drew me in, it fascinated me. I think the subject matter did, I think, you know, where it was set. I think I was kind of outraged by the injustice of everything.
Some sense of warning rose within Tom. Glancing, he saw Kate's looking covertly at the green-scarfed black derby chicken George, who was stepping about in a cocky manner, visually inspecting items of merchandise. Intuitively, Tom was heading toward his father to accomplish a quick exit when Kate's voice cut through the store.
"Hey, boy, fetch me a dipper of water from that bucket over there."
Kate was gazing directly at Tom, the eyes taunting, menacing. Tom's insides congealed, as under the threat of a white man's direct order, he walked stony-faced to the bucket and returned with a dipper of water. Kate drank it at a gulp, his small eyes over the dipper's rim, now on Chicken George, who stood with his head slowly shaking. Kate thrust the dipper toward him.
"I'm still thirsty."
Avoiding any quick moves, Chicken George drew from his pocket his carefully folded freedom paper and handed it to Kate's. Kate unfolded it and read.
"What are you doing in our county?"
he asked coldly.
"He my pappy,"
Tom put in quickly. Above all, he did not want his father attempting any defiant talk. He'd just been given his freedom.
Roots by Alex Haley and narrated by Marvin Kane is available at the RNIB Talking Books Library. Is there a book that you would curl up with on a rainy day and like to reread, apart from Roots?
Oh, I'm not very good with rereading books, which is probably why I've not reread Roots. The other one that I keep meaning to reread is To Kill a Mockingbird.
Cecil Jacobs knew what one was, though. When his turn came, he went to the front of the room and began, "Old Hitler."
"Adolf Hitler, Cecil," said Miss Gates. "One never begins with old anybody."
"Yes, ma'am," he said. "Old Adolf Hitler has been persecuting Cecil." "No, Miss Gates, it says here, well, anyway, old Adolf Hitler has been after the Jews and he's putting them in prisons and he's taking away all their property and he won't let any of them out of the country and he's washing all the feeble-minded and..."
"Washing the feeble-minded?"
"Yes, ma'am, Miss Gates. I reckon they don't have enough sense enough to wash themselves.
I don't reckon an idiot could keep himself clean.
Well, anyway, Hitler started a program to round up all the half-Jews, too, and he wants to register them in case they might want to cause him any trouble, and I think that's a bad thing, and that's my current event."
"Very good, Cecil," said Miss Gates. puffing. Cecil returned to his seat.
To Kill a Mockingbird is written by Harper Lee and narrated by Marvin Kane and is available at the R&IB Talking Books Library.
It's just got such a lovely message, hasn't it? I mean, it just, I think that gave me sort of a guide to how one should be in this life, you know, caring and fight for what's wrong and loving and caring for one another, I guess, and sticking up for the person, the underdog.
So is there a book that you've read recently that you loved and that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
And an evening when I sort of switch off and everything, I do like to read books that are very, very escapist. And at the moment, I'm really enjoying wading through all of Jackie Collins. So I've sort of done the Lucky series and I'm kind of now doing the Hollywood series.
Captain Lacoste said, "You want to take it." He indicated the thick file on his desk. "But you know, we've done everything we can. His description is across the country, his photo, his fingerprints. The next move is his." Leon said, "I know that. I just feel there's something we're missing, and I want to go over that file again. I need to take my time over it." He picked it up. There was nothing in it he didn't already know. He left the captain's office and went straight outside to his car. It was raining. Leon was annoyed about losing his raincoat. It was the genuine English article purchased by a good friend at Burberry's in London and brought back as a special birthday present. The thought of Joey the hooker parading around town in it burned him up. He thought about getting in his car and going out to look for her. But after a long, hot shower, the idea of venturing once more into the filthy night did not appeal to him. So instead, he put on his pajamas, poured himself a substantial glass of brandy, and settled down to watch an old Western on television.
Hollywood Wives is written by Jackie Collins and narrated by Maxine Howe and is available at the R&IB Talking Books Library.
I just think she's such a good storyteller. And I think, you know, at the moment, there's so much, oh gosh, I mean, you know, the news is just so serious. It's so sad. It's so worrying and so unjust in a lot of ways. I think we all need a little bit of lightness in our lives. And I think Jackie Collins can bring that. So I think if you feel like a little bit of lightness, a great story, she's quite insightful with her sort of characters. Yeah, give her a try.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Amanda, for joining us on Read On.
Ah, well, thank you for having me.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.